Hi, Michael.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
I'm fine, and you?
I'm doing okay. I should introduce us. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Michael Young. You're the opinion editor of the Daily Star in Beirut, which is where you are now, I take it.
That's right.
And you're also the author of a book last year about Lebanon, right? It came out last year. Do you want to talk about that a little?
Well, the book is called The Ghosts of Martyr Square,
mm-hmm.
an eyewitness account of, I have to remember at this stage, of Lebanon's life struggle. And mm-hmm. it's about Lebanon after 2005, but in a sense it's really an effort at a political essay on Lebanon, on Lebanese society and political culture.
Okay. Well, I do want to talk about Lebanon in the course of this. I wanted to start off by talking about Syria because it's kind of a burning issue, and I know you have your opinions on that. I think you're unhappy with American policy towards Syria and in a sense almost with the world's policy towards Syria. I think you'd like to see a number of nations do more to accelerate regime change there, as I understand it. So could you start out by just telling us why Syria matters, maybe from an American point of view even, you know, how it influences events that ultimately matter to America?
Sure. I mean, I'm not so much bothered by American policy towards Syria. I mean, I'm mm-hmm. bothered by the fact that America doesn't seem to have a policy towards Syria.
Okay.
And indeed, I mean, Syria is, you know, there's a famous book that came out a few decades ago by the author Patrick Seal called The Struggle for Syria. And Seal made the argument that Syria, in a sense, was the traditional battleground between the two major forces at the time in the 50s and 60s in the Arab world, you know, Iraq and Egypt. And in a way, Syria is indeed remains very much of a vital it remains at the heart of the Arab world in many respects. More recently, of course, the struggle for Syria has been a struggle not between Iraq and Egypt, but between, in many respects, between Iran on the one side, the Arab countries on the other, and to a different extent, perhaps more recently, Turkey. And, you know, the Western powers, the United States, and so on. Why is Syria important today to the United States? Well, to my mind, the outcome in Syria will have obviously a fundamental impact on what happens in the Levant, on what happens on the Palestinian front, what happens in Iraq to a certain extent. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to have a policy on Syria, not to really know what your desired end game in Syria is, I think, a big problem for the United States. And it's just something I think that will, as I said, the absence of a policy has created a vacuum. And mm-hmm. this will have an impact on American interests. But if you're not concerned about American interests, it is obviously having also an impact on Arab interests. I think the Arab states have not had a real policy towards Syria either. They've been divided on it. Okay. So, I mean, okay. Yes, I do blame Washington, but, you know, you can blame a lot of people.
Yeah, and just to flesh out the nature of the influence in that region. So, you know, Syria, I mean, first of all, it's in a state of enmity with Israel, I guess, because Israel occupies the Golan Heights. At least that's the stated, the primary stated Syrian grievance. And then Syria, I gather, serves as a conduit for arms that travel from Iran to Hezbollah. Right, which I guess is of considerable interest to you, since you live in the country where Hezbollah certainly matters, and it's a concern to America because of Hezbollah's antagonistic relationship to Israel, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And then, am I leaving out other major things on the ground? I mean, I guess there's a relationship to Hamas that's not as prominent as the one with Hezbollah, what main things am I leaving out?
In other words, things
that might change if the regime in Syria changed, in other words.
Well, I mean, I think that sketch you drew was quite a, it was quite a broad sketch. It means there is an impact on the Palestinian issue, there is an impact on Lebanon and Hezbollah, there is an impact on Iran, which in mm-hmm. effect, it's going to affect the balance of power between the Arab states and Iran. The United States and Iran, Israel. No, I mean, I think you've covered most of the bases. I think we can throw in also Turkey, because what happens in Syria is really going to have a fundamental impact also on Turkey.
And how is that exactly?
Well, Turkey is a country that has... Why don't we start with one of the major issues that the Turks are looking at? It's the matter of the Kurds. The Turkey has had this long and very tense relationship with its Kurdish minority. Now, the Turks were not happy with the growing autonomy of the Kurds in Iraq, but they seem to have arrived at some kind of a modus vivendi. I think what worries the Turks is that the Kurds of Syria and the PKK, you know, the Kurdish party, the leading Kurdish party in Turkey, also has influence amongst Syria's Kurds. Mm-hmm. And there is a worry on behalf of the Turks that if there is an autonomous Kurdistan, or if the Kurds demand more autonomy in Syria after the breakdown of the Syrian state, that this would, of course, have an impact on Turkey's Kurds. There are other issues. There is, of course, the Arab, the Alawite minority in Turkey, and I'm not talking here about the Alevis, I'm talking about those Alawites who, for the listeners, there was the Iskenderun province, which used to be part of Turkey, was incorporated into Turkey in the 20th century, earlier, I believe it was 1920 or just around then. And there is an Alawite minority in Iskenderun province, which is the Turks called Hatay. Mm-hmm. And of course, if there is a civil war in Syria in which the Alawite minority in Syria is engaged, this will of course also have an impact on their brethren across the border in Turkey. So, I mean, it's a typical mishmash of very complicated interests.
Okay, and so you've highlighted some reasons that some of Syria's neighbors, like Turkey, might not welcome instability, and as much as they might be less than delighted with the current regime, they might have preferred that the regime just be able to hang on for the sake of sheer stability. And even Israel, some people would put in that catalog. You know, the current Syrian regime is the devil they know, and there's been essentially peaceful coexistence for a long time between Israel and Syria, of course, discounting the role that Syria plays as a conduit of weapons to Hezbollah, which but notwithstanding that, some people say Israel actually worries about instability in Syria. So I think your view is that there may be these various reasons that people worry about regime change in Syria or instability in Syria, but I think you believe we've gotten past the point where you can realistically expect for the regime to kind of gracefully preserve its position as the ruler of Syria, right? I mean, is it your view that, look, regime change is coming whether or not the world helps, or we might as well do what we can to guide it, or what exactly?
Precisely. I mean, I think you've stated my position better than I could. I think at this point it's an academic game. Amongst those regimes who feel that somehow, or those individuals who think that the Syrian regime will survive this. I mean, I felt as early as March that the Syrian regime would not survive this, because the problem is not, you know, you can repress, and sometimes you can repress successfully, but in a sense the Pandora's box was opened as early as March of this year, I think. When, in a way, the regime responded with such violence, and it could only respond with that violence because it realized that this was existential, that this was an existential threat, that in a way, it was, as they saw it probably, the rise of the Sunnis. Now, I would argue at the same time that the Syrian opposition has not portrayed its struggle against the regime in those terms, in those sectarian terms. But the reaction of the regime was very much a sectarian reaction. And yes, indeed, I think at this point we are beyond the stage where the Syrian regime will be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again. Mm-hmm. The Assad regime has lost all legitimacy. I think it lost this actually some time ago, long before the United States and anyone else asked Bashar al-Assad to step down. Mm-hmm. That's why I felt that months ago there must have, you know, it would have been much more preferable for the Arab states and the United States and those countries with an interest in Syria to basically read the tea leaves, see where this was heading. Now, it's easy to mm-hmm. say. I'm a journalist. I'm sitting at a desk. Diplomats have a tougher time of it. But I can't say that that this is any surprise to me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And is it your view that one reason the game is up for the Syrian regime is the technological environment in which it finds itself? You know, of course, decades ago, the regime killed many more people than it has killed so far in this round and succeeded in squashing the dissent and hung on. But I think I think you've written about the role of these new information technologies in making it harder to stay in power through brutality.
Well, I think also, Bob, yes, they did in 1982 crush an uprising in Hama. It was a Muslim Brotherhood uprising. This was not a broad uprising of the kind we're seeing today. This was an armed uprising by, you know, essentially an Islamist group. Today, it's something much wider that we're seeing in Syria. Okay. it is much more anchored, I think. It's anchored in deep Syrian frustration after decades of this debilitating rule. Mm-hmm. And I think, obviously, it is, as you suggested, I mean, the Syrians did, in a way, are seeing what's going on around them in the region, what happened in Egypt, mm-hmm. in Tunisia, in Libya. But, you know, I think also we can explain it within the context of developments within Syria over the years. I think Bashar al-Assad has made a number of mistakes. I think that he and the ruling family, in a way, have tended to centralize power. The balancing game that the Bashar's father, Hafez, used to play, he's made several mistakes in that front. You know, he's tended to, the pillars of his regime have narrowed over time. He lost Lebanon in 2005, which I think did have, to a certain extent, an economic cost on Syria. Though, ultimately, it could have been used advantageously had he done that, had the Syrian president opted to do that. But, you know, it's more than just information technology. I'm not one who believes that, you know, information is the key issue. If I could just disagree maybe with an ambiguity in what you said. I think there are fundamental challenges to this regime that have been growing over time, as they have in other countries for different reasons. And it exploded. And I think when it exploded, the regime was unable to, in a way, contain it. It was perhaps possible in February to contain it and in March, but the regime, instead of, you know, balancing soft and hard power, immediately escalated to the most brutal policies possible in Daraa. And in a way, you know, suddenly lost what had been one of its key constituencies. The Sunni tribes of the south that, you know, often been people who, you know, who had backed the Ba'ath Party, who had benefited from the party.
And we should add that this is a case where the ruling regime is a minority ethnicity. These are Alawites, which is a Shia sect ruling a country that is majority Sunni, right?
That's right. But I would as true as that is, and as much as the regime has responded precisely in sectarian terms, but I think over the decades, the father of Bashar, Hafez, often tried to water that down to a certain extent. As we saw in 1982, it wasn't always successful. But he tried to water that down in sort of an Arab nationalist image of the regime. He did it skillfully. I think that what happened in this particular case, while Bashar probably would have been able to contain the dissatisfaction early on, what happened is that immediately the regime reacted in the most brutal way, in a way that was perceived as sectarian in the south, but also events in the northwest, the cities of, you know, in that area where you have mixed Sunni Alawite communities, sort of the major Sunni agglomerations in Syria. Mistakes were made. Great brutality was used. And in a sense, you know, brutality engendered a much greater counter-reaction, and so on and so forth.
Yeah,
so,
and in fact, I read recently that there are now signs that the opposition, there may be the organized use of violence on the part of the opposition. I mean, there had already been reports, actually, we should say, of atrocities being committed by at least some people in the opposition, you know, captured Syrian soldiers having their heads cut off or their eyes gouged out or so on, at least anecdotally. But now, I gather we're starting to see the possibility of true sustained civil war. Is that your reading?
I think we should be careful before. That's quite possible. I fear that it may be possible. Mm-hmm. But I think that, you know, let's not jump the gun just yet. There are indeed soldiers who have deserted from the Syrian army, who are, in a way, fighting against their former comrades. These are, by and large, Sunni deserters, it seems. The numbers, it's unclear how many there are. Some of the officers suggest that it may be as high as, what, 10, 15,000. It's not clear. I think that we should be careful with the figures. I think that we're at a very critical stage in this uprising where it can go one of two ways. I believe that this new council that the opposition has formed, which formed in Turkey last week, would like as much as possible to avoid resorting or collapsing into violence. I think that the advice from the international community is the same thing. Avoid violence. Violence will end up, in a way, playing right into the hands of the regime, which would then be able to, in a sense, you know, declare all-out war.
Right.
I think that the opposition is very conscious of this. The question now is, can it manage to impose on this very, you know, amorphous group of people, of opposition groups, can it impose a policy to avoid violence, to avert as much as possible a resort to violence? Because obviously, once you get into a civil war, the logic of civil war, aside from the obviously the destruction and the polarization that this will cause, but in a sense, the regime may be able to take advantage of this to a certain extent. It may able to. Please go ahead.
Sure. I mean, go ahead and finish your thought. I mean, the regime wants to, I guess you're saying, depict the opposition as violent and thus justify cracking down even harder. Is that your?
That's right. That's right. Having said that, what it wants to do, I think, it realizes it has cracked down already fairly violently now. But I think that it feels that if it can depict any kind of conflict in Syria as a conflict between the regime and Sunni Islamists, that in a way it would tremendously complicate Western decision-making, the decision-making in part of the Arab world. In other words, many countries would begin to say, well, wait a minute, do we really want an Islamist opposition to win? This at least would, I think, is the calculation of the Syrian regime. I don't think they'll succeed.
You're saying it wants to characterize this as a sectarian conflict, or
absolutely, the regime from the outset has tried
which is
to
odd,
exacerbate.
It's the minority ethnicity. Right. I wouldn't think that if I were the minority ethnicity, I would want to turn it into a battle between ethnicities, even if I have a disproportionate amount of the kind of hardware and stuff.
But that's precisely the. I mean, you're making what is a logical statement, and I agree with it. But I think that the regime has calculated differently. I think they've calculated that between, as you say, they control the hardware. The Praetorian units of the army are controlled pretty much by the Alawis, the air force. I think they feel that if you exacerbate the sectarian polarization, you would be doing two things. You would be, on the one hand, as I said earlier, you would create this semblance that the fight is a fight against Sunni Islamists, on the one hand. On the other hand, you would mobilize the Alawi community and ensure that there are no breakdown in the unity of Alawi ranks, which, by the way, is something that should we shouldn't underestimate, you see.
Right.
In other words, if the Alawis represent 12-14% of the Syrian population and have the guns, mm-hmm. and at the same time have, you know, are allied with other fearful minorities, Christians, mm-hmm. to a certain extent the Druze, I think the regime's calculation is that they would be able, and let's not forget, there are Sunnis with the regime. Many of the people that you see day in and day out defending the regime, mm-hmm. On television, Buthayna Sha'ban, Faisal Maghdad, these are Sunnis. These are not Alawis.
Okay.
Buthayna Sha'ban is not an Alawi. You know, I think the regime's calculation is that it would be able to impose a status quo, a stalemate.
Okay.
And then negotiate on that basis, negotiate mm-hmm. on its conditions.
Okay. So now, on the prospects, I think your hope is still that this could be resolved in an essentially peaceful fashion. I mean, you say there is hope that this won't turn into a civil war, and I think that what you put a lot of emphasis on is the need for the international community to impose, you know, nonviolent pressure on Syria and get some regime change. What puzzles me about that is the expectation that Assad would ever step down peacefully, especially in light of what happened to Mubarak in Egypt, who thought that he would step down and spend his rest of his life in a pleasant resort town and wound up in prison. And you know, even if Assad's own people don't treat him like that, as they did in Egypt, there's the threat of international criminal court. So I have trouble seeing a scenario where he behaves in a fashion fundamentally different from the way Gaddafi behaved.
No, I agree with you. I mean, I don't see that scenario either. But I think, look, a peaceful resolution to this is not likely. Okay, mm-hmm. When I say I meant to distinguish between a civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And what we have now. I mean, what we have now is violence, sustained violence, but at the same time, a growing cost to the regime, an economic cost, growing isolation, and so forth. But having said that, I don't think that the regime today, if it looks at the, you know, what they used to call the correlation of forces,
mm-hmm.
yet feels that it is isolated enough. I think that the decision of the Russians and the Chinese to veto a UN Security Council resolution gave the regime hope. So I'm not suggesting that the regime is simply going to, you know, pack its bags. I think it more likely that the regime and the Alawis, if they feel at some stage that they can no longer hold out, okay,
mm-hmm.
They may opt for a plan B, which is sort of, you know, let's redeploy towards an Alawi heartland, okay, towards the northeast of Syria, where you have the Alawi mountains, you know, the cities of Lediyye, Tartus, and so forth, you know, sort of that to, you know, try to create some kind of a fallback position, to fall back on what they would imagine to be an Alawi statehood. Now, I would think that is more likely.
Which might indeed lead to two states, in your view, or you imagine that eventually, they would be pursued until they were hunted down and Syria remained a single state?
Yes. No, I don't think that such a project would work, but I think it more likely that before the Assads decide to pack up and leave Syria by airplane, that they might conceivably think of that kind of project.
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, many of the steps taken by the security forces and the army earlier this year suggest at least that they are trying to protect the, you know, the boundaries of such a potential territory.
But, you know, one of the problems with the modern world in terms of getting rid of dictators is there is no refuge, you know.
Yes,
I mean, I'm basically a supporter of international governance and things kind of like the ICC, but the fact that there is no escape increasingly from bodies like that, you know, makes it harder to get rid of these guys gracefully.
That's true. I mean, up to now, the ICC has not taken up the case of the Assads. That will require some kind of movement by the Security Council, because
mm-hmm.
Syria is not a party to the
mm-hmm.
ICC. But your point is well taken. Ultimately, where do these people go? And if you trap them, in a way, you make a negotiated solution less likely. But you know, that's where we are today in Syria.
You know more than I do, and I certainly hadn't envisioned this scenario where they withdraw to these mountain regions. But on the other hand, if you yourself don't believe that'll be successful, it's not clear to me kind of why they would, knowing the terrain, you know, probably as well as you do. But in general, I guess I'm having trouble imagining a nonviolent regime change in general, in which case. But to be clear, you are not yet advocating a Libya-like solution where there is armed intervention from the outside, right?
Because, no, absolutely not. I think that would be a disaster. I don't think it'll work. I'm not advocating even arming the Syrian opposition. I think that would be a disaster. Mm-hmm. I think the only way that this, you know, it's a very tough situation. I agree with you that. A non-violent ending is we're really talking about degrees of violence here.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about civil war being one extreme, and a continuation of the violence today, and essentially, you know, this sort of war of, you know, this sort of wearing down of each of the regime at the other extreme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which is violent. I mean, you know, I think the official figures for the death is much lower than reality. The other day I was hearing Samir Aita, who is an opposition figure, saying 80,000 people are in prison, have been in prison.
Mm-hmm.
That's a tremendous amount of people. So I don't believe seriously that there will be a nonviolent ending.
Mm-hmm.
But what I think you can do is that if there is diplomatic isolation of Syria, and an effort to, you know, and when I say diplomatic isolation, I mean it would have been nice to bring in the Russians and the Chinese on this. They may yet at a later stage change their mind. But playing on that front, economically, continuing as much as possible to tighten the noose on the regime, because this is a regime that in a way can be made to suffer economically. In terms of paying its units, in terms of the regime last week took an economic significant economic decision. It later backtracked on it, but the decision was not to allow imports that had a higher customs duty than 5%. The obvious message here was that the regime does not want hard currency to leave the Syrian economy, to leave Syria.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately for them, they had to reverse that because obviously this measure would harm the commercial class, which supports the regime. But it shows you very much the dilemma the regime is in. In other words, it can at some point conceivably run out of money. Gaddafi did have oil, but Bashar doesn't have that kind of. He does have allies in Iran. He does have a certain amount of support in Iraq, oddly enough, but. You know, conceivably, you can over time, if diplomatic isolation builds up, if the regime begins to fail to crush the rebellion, that you will begin to see splits even within the ranks of the Alawi community saying, well, wait a minute, where are we heading?
Mm-hmm.
It is conceivable that you will begin to find openings. But, you know, like you, I don't think this is going to happen in the short term.
Okay.
This is going to be, you know, a long process.
Okay, and then finally, let me, before we maybe venture beyond the Syria question, there is the what comes next question, and I think this may account for some of the reluctance of the outside world to get involved in a more thoroughgoing way. I mean, you know, as we've seen in Egypt, the people who lead the opposition are not necessarily representative of the people who are going to wind up in power, even in the event of a fundamentally democratic transition. I mean, you know, you have these secular cosmopolitan types who are out there on the forefront, but of course they're not a majority of Egyptians. They're unusually well educated and everything else, and it's very unclear what the new regime is going to look like in Egypt. You might say so that in Syria too, we don't have a very clear idea. You know, we talked about ways in which Syria is an irritant. Regionally and problems that it is the source of, but you know, I think Well, there are two questions. I mean, to what extent has the character of this regime been the problem? I mean, with respect to Israel, this regime actually seems to have been willing, in principle, to do a land for peace deal on the Golan Heights, and I gather that the WikiLeaks documents revealed that Turkey was orchestrating talks that were apparently making progress when Israel launched the Gaza, the cast lead operation and disrupted the whole thing, and Turkey was very upset about Israel for that. So I guess at a minimum I would say it's certainly not clear to me that you're going to wind up with a successor regime that is any less hostile to Israel or any less willing to do business with Israel. And then there's just the more there's the more general uncertainty of the thing, you know? I mean, who knows? I mean, given your own admission that, yeah, this probably doesn't progress in a totally peaceful way, given the fact that it may turn violent, and we don't know exactly which fissures, you know, will be the dividing lines. Will it be fundamentally sectarian or anything else? Isn't it kind of hard to have confidence that the next regime will be any better? Or do you think it's a pretty good bet that the next regime will on balance be more conducive to maybe regional peace and order?
Well, look, I mean, you know, I think at this point it's obviously an academic question more. The fact is that we're going towards something different. Mm-hmm. Even if Bashar manages somehow to stay in power, we're going towards something fundamentally different. If I could focus on the issue of Israel, I think you may be mixing up two things. I think you're absolutely right to say that Israel and this particular regime in Syria were the best of enemies. I'm never one who believed that the Syrians really wanted a final deal, at least since Bashar came to power, a final deal on the Golan. I think they wanted negotiations because it protected them, because it basically allowed them to play politics, to play in the marketplace of and to break their isolation after 2005, when they were isolated at the time when they were blamed for the assassination of Rafiq Hariri in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. I don't really believe that the Syrians were serious then about a final deal. And the reason being, we can see why today, because a final deal really will impose a dismantling, to a certain extent, of this entire security edifice, which props up the Alawi minority. Mm-hmm. If you have peace, you cannot spend, you know, an enormous amount of money on security, on your army, on essentially what is a Praetorian, the Praetorian guard of the Syrian regime.
Okay.
But at the same time, you're quite right to say that if you let's assume you have a democratic regime in Syria. Let's look at the best option. A democratic regime. Well, I think from Israel's perspective, this would be the worst option, precisely because suddenly Israel's ability to hold on to the Golan, mm-hmm. when it's facing a legitimate democratic Syrian government, mm-hmm. will be very different than its legitimacy when it's facing what is, you know, perceived as a Syrian dictatorship.
Right.
Suddenly, the reality, I think, is that, yes, the Syrian population, by and large, mm-hmm. I think, would like a return of the Golan Heights to Syria. Unlike the Syrian regime, which mm-hmm. I think often used the Golan as a card to play, I always thought that, frankly, the priority of the Syrian regime was Lebanon. Lebanon brought them money. Lebanon brought them power. Lebanon brought them regional influence. The Golan was never as fundamental to them as Lebanon.
Okay, but I think, if I could just finish the sentence, Bob,
I think that the Syrian population is much more sincere about getting the Golan back for the Golan's sake.
Right, but okay, to get back to this point you just made about how a democratic Syria is more threatening to Israel, and you think because of its actual perceived legitimacy, and I gather that the difficulty Israel would have demonizing it, perhaps, if I understand you, if you see the outcome of regime change likely leading to a situation that's more threatening to Israel, and you are puzzled by America's failure to intervene to accelerate that regime change, I think we should have a discussion about American politics. In other words, I don't understand how you can expect America to pursue a policy towards Syria that is going to lead to result that Israel finds very unappetizing, if you see what I mean.
But it did. But it ultimately it did in Egypt as well. I mean, in Egypt, it finally, you know, gave Mubarak the boot, knowing very well that the aftermath would be, you know, much more unpredictable than before. Look, to be very honest with you, I don't think the U.S. has a policy on or a clear policy on Syria. I'm sure that the point you just raised certainly was factored in. But I think there were other factors in American thinking on Syria. And at some point, it may even have become a question. I think there was the fear of the Islamists. That's one factor. What comes afterwards? You know, that was obviously at the heart of the American discussion. But I think at some point, there was also the contrary view. It's that, well, we cannot protect Libyans in Benghazi from a massacre by Gaddafi. One month, and then look as thousands of Syrians are being slaughtered in the street by their regime, you know, for 6 months. You know, I think in a way it's never black and white. It's always very much, you know, it's very complicated. There are plenty of grays here. And today the Americans have taken a position, clearly. They took it very late, but they've taken it. It's that Bashar should go. So I think already today the Americans are adapting to a very dynamic situation in the Middle East. I hope they realize at some point that, you know, this is America's chance in the Middle East. Frankly, I've always thought that American reliance on dictators was, you know, almost a certain source of American decline in the Middle East. America was associated with the worst. And in many respects, America protected the stalemate. You're right to raise this issue. I think that the United States' position, its willingness to consider, to play with the dynamics of the region, or I hope its willingness, to accept that, okay, you may have less predictability in the future, but at least you will have perhaps more pluralistic regime, that this is a door through which the United States can play, you know, a role in the Middle East. And frankly, in Syria, I think the U.S., up to now, while it delayed for a long time taking any position on Syria, but at least one thing is positive. It is on the side of those in the streets who are being, you know, who are being shot. That's something that I hope the U.S. will be able to exploit. But I don't know. I mean, Obama is not always the most ambitious of presidents.
Well, he started out ambitious, but some of his Middle East initiatives didn't work out as well as he had hoped. And now we're entering a presidential campaign season, which I think is a really significant constraint. I don't think, for example, he wants to start down a path in Syria that can be depicted as a failure. I mean, if he stands up and says Assad must go within 3 months, and then 3 months later Assad's not gone, the Republicans are going to exploit that. So I think he's going to be even more careful than he might otherwise.
But what you're saying is alarming, Bob. What you're essentially saying is that basically domestic politics are and we know that's the case, but domestic politics are essentially shaping his, you know, what is a an important foreign policy issue. I mean, the point is that in the region today, certainly, I don't think anyone would dispute the fact that if the regime falls, this would be a significant blow to Iran. The Iranians know that. That's why they've been supporting as much as they can the Assad regime. If today Barack Obama is making his decisions based on the next election, and he probably is, you're absolutely right, but this worries me. You know, what about your broader strategic calculations in the Middle East?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I view the system as sufficiently chaotic that I don't feel confident saying weakening the ally of your enemy is necessarily going to help you. I mean, for example, I don't think we need Iran to be in more of a bunker mentality than it's already in. I don't think we want to make it easy for Iran's leaders to say to their people, you're even more threatened than you thought you were. But, you know, I'm not saying it would be bad or that it wouldn't be good in this context for Iran's ally regime to fall. I'm just saying I think that's a really messy part of the world. And one thing Americans have learned, and I think this also accounts for a certain reluctance that you may be witnessing to get more involved in Syria, is that the Iraq and Afghanistan wars went quite differently from the way we had planned. And, I don't think Obama is a fundamental realist at heart in terms of foreign policy at heart. But at the same time, I think we've learned that upsetting apple carts can lead to unpredictable results.
Well, that's precisely why I think you need a strategy. I mean, I think that's why if there is chaos and confusion, I don't think it's the role of the United States to sit back and say, well, you know, this is a bit of a mess. Let's just sit back.
Well,
I mean, if there is a country in the world that has the ability, I think, to shape or to shape this chaos to a certain extent, without overstating the issue, but that has the ability to shape it, that can speak to the Arab states, that can speak to the European states, that can speak at the United Nations, that can speak to the Russians and the Chinese. It's the United States. I understand that. It's a complex situation. It's very easy to give, you know, they say it should do this, it should do that. But the fact of the matter is that the United States on Syria has not done much. Has not done much. Today, the ambassador in Syria, his role is, quote, to bear witness. Well, that's great. I think that's a very important role for an ambassador to bear witness. But I really think the ambassador's role in general must be a bit more than that. It must be to advance a policy.
Yeah, I mean, I think in this case, the ambassador has done one of the things you think is in America's interest to do, which is make it clear where our sympathies lie. And I think that's probably especially very late.
To Ford's credit, mm-hmm. I think that Ford managed to fill the space of ambiguity mm-hmm. in policy towards Syria. He managed to fill it quite well, and it's to his credit.
Mm-hmm. But I would say it seems to me that, you know, one of the main actual security threats that America faces these days is not so much the traditional threat of war with another nation state, but it could happen. We could get drawn into war with Iran even. But as, of course, the threat of terrorism, which now is kind of modest, but if it is exacerbated and eventually it intersects with weapons of mass destruction, I think that's one of the bigger long-term threats. If you accept that premise, then, of course, the thing we most want to avoid is the thing we stumbled into in Iraq and Afghanistan, which is policies that allow us to be depicted as occupying forces in Muslim nations, as at war with Islam. And I don't know how that consideration should play out in Syria. I can see how it would lead to a reluctance to get drawn into anything like what looks like a sectarian civil war, because you kind of can't win in that case, right? If it's Sunni versus Shia, the people you're helping probably won't be as grateful as you'd like, and the people that you're opposed to will turn this into serious propaganda against you, and jihadist recruiters will make use of it. And so on. So I think that would be a legitimate concern on the part of the administration. At the same time, I agree with you that makes it in our interest to do what I think we did somewhat successfully in Egypt and to do what Ambassador Ford is kind of trying to do with Syria, which is at least establish that we are broadly speaking on the side of people who are speaking up for the right of Arabs and Muslims broadly, you know, to govern their own future, if that makes any sense. Okay.
Well, if I could answer, I have two responses. I mean, two comments on that. I fear that the diplomatic vacuum makes more likely a situation where you're going to have jihadists. Sunni, you know, Sunni radicalization in the Sunni community in Syria and so forth. I mean, my point is that as long as you don't have a policy, as long as you're not in a way pushing the international community to, or helping the international community to create some kind of broad framework to manage the situation, you're going to have a vacuum. And this vacuum is very dangerous, I think. In other words, even the Russians, their argument that somehow by not taking a decision, you know, we were trying to avoid civil war, I think it made more likely a civil war. Because if you don't have anyone intervening under the rubric of the UN or some kind of broad strategic proposal, some broad proposal, in a way, you're basically allowing the situation to slip out of hand, or making that more likely. The second point, I mean, it's a philosophical issue I have. I mean, I'm always, whenever I hear American, you know, spokesmen talk about, you know, we don't want to alienate the Muslim world. We don't want to be perceived as being against the Muslims. We don't want to be seen as occupying. You know, I think Americans have tended to see in the last 10 years foreign policy as basically an issue of popularity, as a popularity contest. And, you know, it's almost something, you know, if you recall this whole issue of public diplomacy. Now, I think it's important, public diplomacy. But I think you had a very correct statement saying that sometimes whatever you do, you're not going to win. The fact is the United States is not going to win in many of these countries in the Middle East, whatever it does.
Well, my own critique, if I could say, of public diplomacy is a little different. I agree it didn't do much good, but it's not because whatever you do, we're screwed. It's because you can do all the public diplomacy you want, but if your troops are in Iraq, they're in Iraq. And if your troops are in Afghanistan, they're in Afghanistan, and that fact can be used against you. So, and if you're providing Israel with the weapons that are killing Palestinians, you're doing that. And until you change the actual policies, that's all true.
That's all true. But ultimately, the U.S. is a superpower. The U.S., you know, what is the goal? Popularity? Well, if the U.S. withdraws from the world, it may become very popular. In the same way that, you know, Switzerland is popular, or Portugal, you know, these. But ultimately, I'm not advocating starting wars all over the world, and nor can the U.S. afford that anymore. But my point is that you have to have some kind of strategic vision in the Middle East, specifically, since we're talking about the Middle East. If today popularity is what is going to shape your policy, that's a mistake. What will make the United States more effective in the Middle East is an effective policy. This can involve force, it can involve public diplomacy, it can involve soft power. You know, it has to involve a complex array of approaches, human rights at the heart of it. I think this is my own view. And I share your point on Israel, by the way. I think the U.S. is making a very big mistake on this Palestinian statehood issue. But the point I'm making is that, you know, ultimately nothing will make you as popular as success. I don't think that the United States was particularly popular in the 1970s when Henry Kissinger was mediating between Egypt and Israel. I grew up in that period, and I can tell you the U.S. was not particularly popular. But the fact is it had a policy. And when Anwar al-Sadat attacked in the Sinai, his address was the United States. The point is, well, the Americans are strong. I'm going to provoke a war to basically deal with them. And, you know, that's the way I see things. In this sense, I'm not a realist in many things, but in this sense, I'm a realist. Ultimately, popularity should not be what guides your policy. What should guide your policy is effective policy.
Well, we all agree that effective policy is the best policy. The question is what role popularity plays in effective policy. Right. And I would argue that the role of popularity has fundamentally changed since the 1970s.
Here in America,
I'll tell you what the threat seems like is – We worry about Iran, and I think we should worry about being drawn into war with them. But fundamentally, the security threat seems to be terrorism, and there's a small but troubling trend of an increase in homegrown terrorist attacks or conspiracies that are uncovered or whatever. You can imagine that actually getting out of hand, right? If we respond to it as stupidly as we responded to 9/11, in my view, and actually kind of throw fuel on the fire, this could become a very significant threat because it's very easy to do terrorism, right? If enough Muslims become alienated. So from my point of view, the whole jihadist enterprise around the world, which is, of course, interconnected with the threat of homegrown terrorism, is the fundamental security threat to America. And the magnitude of that threat has very much to do, you know, not so much with popularity, but with not so much with the whole world loving us, but with not tons and tons of Muslims hating us, okay? I think we're actually living in an age because a variety of technological trends have made it easier for aggrieved peoples who don't have the instruments of state at their disposal to nonetheless organize and wield violence. I think because we're living in that age, actually, the grassroots sentiment toward the United States should be one of the most important variables in our national security calculus, and I think that's very different from the 1970s. So I would not...
There is an element of degree. I mean, I think you're right to a certain extent. I don't share, I don't think it's the biggest threat, homegrown terrorism, to be honest. I think it is a threat. It's something to be watched carefully. I don't think it's the biggest threat. And I certainly don't feel that the way to resolve this issue is simply to try to say, well, we want to, you know, change our image in the Arab world. I mean, I think ultimately, you know, we're talking about the strategic interests of the United States, of the empire.
We agree. Well, I'm not. I don't want it to be an empire, but I agree with you that that's a strategic interest.
Well, fortunately, it is an empire. It may be an empire in decline, or it may not. Things change.
And empires decline is not the word we have to use. We could use the word a redeployment of emphasis. In other words, you can choose to convert from an empire into a mere influential nation if you want.
Yes, you can, as Britain did after World War II, and that was essentially the end of the empire. Now, I'm not suggesting we're at this stage at all in the United States, by the way. I'm not saying that. What I'm saying, and I agree that today the United States is at a crossroads in terms of its own image of itself in the world, no doubt about it. But I don't think that this should be shaped overly by a fear of domestic Muslims who probably represent a very small minority, and who, yes, they certainly do represent a threat, but I don't think that shaping your foreign policy is going to have a substantial impact. Look, the point is, I don't, you know, as these individuals who have attacked the United States, we're not talking about 9/11, we're talking about the attacks afterwards. I mean, these are individuals who fundamentally, in most cases, believed that there was something at the heart evil in the United States. They were not reacting merely, it was not merely a reaction to what the U.S. was doing in Afghanistan or in Iraq. It was partly that. I think at the heart of it, there was something more profound.
Yeah.
It was that this is a system that is in and of itself an unjust system. This is in and of itself a system that is, you know, that we cannot accept. And so no amount of policy is ever going to convince a certain group of people, you know, that to change their behavior.
Well, I mean, we don't know. The fact is they were pointing to policies that actually existed, and it goes beyond Iran and Afghanistan. You know, Osama bin Laden could correctly state that when he came back from Afghanistan, damn it, there were American troops in Saudi Arabia. Now, that was actually a fact that didn't have to be a fact, but was. It is also a fact that we have supported these authoritarian regimes, which you and I both think is probably ill-advised, I think, in addition to the facts of Iraq, the facts of Afghanistan, the facts of Israel. So,
well, let me ask you this question.
Do you think
that had the United States, just a quick, let me throw in a question, had the United States supported democratic regimes, a democratic regime in Saudi Arabia, okay, which would have thrown that society, I think, into considerable havoc, that Osama bin Laden would have supported the United States? The reality is he probably would have opposed it even more strenuously.
He might have, but I think even if we hadn't had troops in Saudi Arabia when he came back from Afghanistan, I'm not sure that he would have taken the same path.
I don't think it's up to the United States to allow Osama bin Laden to essentially define its policy with its old partner, namely Saudi Arabia. You see, in other words, when we get into that logic, suddenly every whim of an individual or of a small group of people who don't like the United States becomes suddenly justification for changing American policy. You know, I don't think ultimately that we should give these people that power.
No, it's not every whim of any individual. I mean, he was harnessing a widespread resentment against the United States for a whole array of policies. And in the case of Iran, if you want to go back to the first big prominent emergence of anti-American Islamic fundamentalism, we had, in fact, deposed the democratic regime in 1953 and ushered in a brutal and repressive dictatorship. These things are not imagined. And so, I mean, it's easy to say, look, they're going to hate us no matter what we do. But when we have done so many things that are real, I'm not saying they're going to hate us for whatever we do.
I'm saying there are individuals who will hate you for whatever you do. And these individuals, even if they represent a small minority, can, yes, represent the threat. You're absolutely right. But that should not shape your broader, I think, strategic calculations.
Well, I think they can only be a big threat if there is widespread sentiment that they harness. And there is.
Well, look, I don't think in Saudi Arabia, to be very honest, that there was widespread hostility to the American presence. The Americans were outside the cities. Most Saudis didn't even see them. There is still a major American presence in Qatar, which is not posed problems. You know, I don't think that's the issue. There are many issues that we can raise, American support for Israel, all that. You're absolutely right. These are issues that the Arabs don't like. But that hasn't prevented Arab governments, and even to a certain extent Arab societies, from accepting that you have to deal with the United States, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm. We're nearing the end of our time, and I've utterly failed to do something I promised to do, which is explore Lebanese politics with you in connection with this issue. So I guess if some weeks from now you would still be in the mood for discussing this, I would actually like to talk more to
you.
With
pleasure. If you can wake up enough people to listen to an hour on Lebanon, I'd be glad to do it.
We will do our best. In the meanwhile, I want to emphasize, I think there's some things that we agree on. I think we agree that the Arab Spring represents the drift of things to come. America should be fundamentally on its side for a variety of reasons, including, I think, its own self-interest. I want to emphasize that, as well as the fact that there are values embodied in the Arab Spring worth upholding and even revering, and we can only hope that they prevail amid all the kind of turmoil. And so I think we may kind of agree where we think it makes sense for America to be in the long run. And maybe we should leave it at that, more or less.
No, I agree. Look, I think this is America's big chance. I don't think it's realized this yet. But it's its big chance in the Middle East. The United States was wedded to the most authoritarian, corrupt regimes. Now is its chance to reinvent itself in the region. Maybe a less powerful America in the region, a country, you know, that will allow the region to develop itself. But also, in the long run, this will be a more stable region if this project succeeds. I think it's a project that is ongoing, so, you know, a lot can happen. But I think the U.S. has every interest, I agree with you, to help this project succeed. But that, first of all, involves having some kind of a policy, a more clear policy on the region than it has had until now.
Yeah, I agree that there could be more clarity. I'm pessimistic about the prospects for it emerging in the course of a presidential campaign, and that's a sad comment. But thanks so much for taking the time. And I'm glad you're willing in principle to come back.
Okay, with pleasure, Bob. Thank you. And the conversation continues.
Okay. Take care.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye.